You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Even a typical parent-child relationship can be fraught with questions of guilt, love, and obligation. In his new book, Far From the Tree, Andrew Solomon looks at the most extreme and challenging iterations of this bond, children whose identities are profoundly different from those of their parents, children who are physically or mentally handicapped, children who turn to crime or descend into schizophrenia, children whose needs or difficulties can present challenges beyond those that most parents are prepared for. The book is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Andrew Solomon back to our show. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
You make the point in your introduction that most people will tell you with some pride that they're not at all like their parents. Why are we so happy to distinguish ourselves from the identities of our parents and then so profoundly disturbed when our children turn out to be different from us?
I think we try to create a distance from our own parents because it's a way of asserting independence and character. And I think individuation is important in all societies, but it's been especially important in modern American society, the sense that you become your own person, that you aren't just playing out what your parents set for you, that you've used your own mind and your own imagination. But I think that when we become parents, all of us cherish that incredible intimacy of early childhood where your child wants nothing more than to be in your arms or in your lap or reading a story with you. And I think the sense of your children moving away feels like a catastrophic loss.
Like a rejection.
Yes.
Your title comes from the aphorism that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, an assumption that children are inevitably like their parents.
And what I found is that, of course, all children are unlike their parents. I looked at these more extreme circumstances. I looked at deafness and dwarfism and Down syndrome, schizophrenia, people with multiple severe disabilities, so on and so forth. I'm sure we'll talk about them during the show. But what I really wanted to look at is what happens when your child has an identity, a sort of fundamental defining character trait or experience that's really foreign to the parent.
Well, isn't some of the difficulty of parenting these special needs children that we somehow blame ourselves for it or others blame us for it?
Well, the legacy of blame is strong. I was talking to Jim Watson, he of the discovery of DNA, who has a son with schizophrenia, and he said to me, the most evil man of the 20th century after Adolf Hitler was Bruno Bettelheim, who was the person who had really put forward the idea that autism and schizophrenia were caused by the parents.
Refrigerator moms.
Refrigerator mothers, parents with an unconscious wish their children not exist. And if you go back a couple of hundred years, even physical deformities and dwarfism were considered through a theory called imaginationism, which was the dominant understanding for a long period of time. They were the result of the unexpressed lascivious desires of the mother.
Well, do those kinds of blames still linger? Do people still blame the parents of children who have problems?
People blame the parents of children who have problems. There are some areas in which they blame them a lot. I did a chapter on crime. Parents of criminals are routinely blamed, even though much of the time they are not, in fact, to blame. And people blame themselves. I mean, there was one mother of an autistic child whom I interviewed. She was so bright. She was so articulate. She was so accomplished. And she told me that her son had autism because she'd gone skiing while she was pregnant. And I said, skiing? And she said, yes, and she said the altitude isn't good for the developing fetus. And I thought, okay, there are a lot of theories about autism, but that's not one of them.
On the other hand, you also mentioned statistics about parental murder of children several times in your book. They're shocking statistics. Is it true that half the children who've been murdered are murdered by their parents?
I think it's half the children who've been murdered by women have been murdered by their parents.
In fact, when a woman murders, it's more often than not
her own child, yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, I think a lot of the time that mothers have a sense that they should be able to fix things and make them right. It's what we all want to do with our children. And when they aren't able to fix something, they become more and more frustrated. We also, however, have the problem that a lot of the people who murder their own children claim to have done so for altruistic reasons. My child was suffering and I had to do it. And they mostly don't do any jail time. And if you don't have any punishment for doing it, it opens up the possibility in a very frightening way to dehumanizing people with autism in particular and other disabilities.
Well, earlier there was a time before some laws were changed when it was very common to be tested for possible birth defects, although you can't find out, you don't know about autism, but you can find out about Down syndrome, for example, dwarfism, I assume, and parents would abort their children. That didn't even come up during the debate over abortion in the recent political campaigns.
Right. I think the abortion question is a huge one, and I'm an abortion libertarian and believe anyone who wants an abortion should be able to have one. My concern is to try to explain to people what these lives are that they're choosing not to produce or to have. But I think that's separate from the general question of parents murdering the children, which is something that mostly applies to children who are 10 or 12 or 16. That's very different, I think, from an abortion. To me, it is.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. His National Book Award winning book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is published by Scribner. You talk about horizontal identity. What's that?
So I've said that there's such a thing as vertical identity, which are the identities that are inherited from generation to generation. So your ethnicity is a vertical identity. Your nationality usually is. Your language usually is. Your religion often is. And then there are these other identities in which a child is born who is expressly different from his parents, and his parents have to learn the vocabulary of autism or of prodigious genius or of criminality or of transgenderism or of these other categories. And my idea is that the civil rights movements that related to vertical identities came first because those identities are reinforced from earliest childhood. You can say it's hard to be a black person in the United States as the United States is currently constructed, but no one is trying to make the black children come out white. On the other hand, when you look at these horizontal identities, they present an enormous challenge to families, and the families usually try to cure them or efface them. So I'm the gay child of straight parents. My parents would have preferred that I be straight and did what they could to push me in that direction. Didn't work, but anyway, that was the attempt. So I wanted to look at how do families respond to having these different children, and how do those children at some point get a real feeling of identity?
Well, you say that vertical identities are respected as identities, horizontal identities are seen as flaws. So that, and that's an important part to make that kind of distinction.
Absolutely.
Does the parents wish to mainstream their child, if possible, to intervene in some way, mean anything other than they wish their children's lives to be made a little easier?
You know, there are two threads. One is that the parents want their child's life to be easier. And the other is that the parent may find it embarrassing or humiliating or unpleasant having a child who's ill and having to do all of the things that are connected to that child. And I use the word illness very advisedly, but having a child who's different in some way. And it's often hard to separate out to what extent are they trying to make life better for their kid and to what extent are they trying to conform to their own standards for themselves.
With vertical identities, it's easy to connect to your child, to bond, but they can sustain a relationship. But when you have a horizontal identity, it's really difficult to bond.
It is extremely difficult, and yet a lot of the
But time, aren't bonds of love and acceptance supposed to transcend those flaws? At least we'd like to believe they do.
Well, we'd like to believe they do, and I really feel the message of the book is that they often do. I mean, it has a lot of harrowing stories in it about people confronting enormous difficulty, but they're mostly stories in which love is ultimately triumphant. And while I saw a lot of cost to that love and a lot of struggle associated with it, I did find that while we all know there are abusive and neglectful parents, even of children without any problems and certainly of children with problems, that most people actually love their children and want the best for them.
You say that the genesis of this book was an article you were assigned to write about deaf culture. What did you know about deafness at the time?
At the time, I knew nothing about it, and I thought it was only a disability, and I thought those poor people who can't hear, it's too bad we can't do anything for them. And then I went in to talk to people who are in the deaf culture, and I went to deaf theater, and I went to deaf movies, and I heard or saw deaf poetry, and I was at the Miss Deaf America competition, and as I had those experiences, I became more and more convinced that deafness was a linguistic subculture. It's not my culture, and I didn't want to go deaf and join it, but I had to admit it was as valid as a culture as Jewish culture, gay culture, Latino culture, whatever.
But is it different if it's a vertical or a horizontal situation, if the parents are deaf or the parents are hearing?
If the parents are deaf, the children tend to function better because they've had reinforcement in sign language as a first means of communication from earliest childhood. If the parents are hearing, the parents often focus on oral speech and lip reading, and then as the children get a little bit older, the children discover identity by meeting a peer group. And that's what I mean by horizontal. It's from your peers that you actually do the learning.
Was the controversy at the time the fact that hearing people were running deaf schools, particularly at the Lexington School?
There was a huge controversy about the hearing people running deaf schools. Lexington had just had a new president appointed, and the people who were there felt that it was the wrong person and that it should be a deaf person and not a hearing person. There were big protests at the time.
Well, you mentioned the debate over whether children should be taught to sign or encouraged to try to speak, which is true for deaf children, also true for nonverbal autistic kids.
Yes. I think that the sort of central question in the book is, how do you figure out what about your child can be changed? What about your child should be changed? What about your child should just be left alone? And what about your child should be celebrated? And with a lot of these things, I mean, now there are cochlear implants for deaf people. The questions are very different from what they essentially were when I started 20 years ago looking at these problems. But a lot of the time you find parents who are trying to cure what's not curable, and that's a path to disaster.
And we're still seeing that sort of thing argued over, for example, in California, where there are now court cases over a new law that says that you can't try to straighten out gay people through some kind of conversion therapy.
Right. I think the question is always whether you need to ban cures that don't work. If it were a medical cure, if it were a medication, and it were determined definitively that it not only doesn't work but makes someone much sicker, then I think we would knock it out right away.
Well, how did that work with you? Because you mentioned earlier that your parents would have preferred for you not to be gay.
And I think I would have preferred at that time for me not to be gay. And the life
you
I
mean
have...
gay people don't choose that lifestyle as... some people claim.
Oh, dear. We're back to the choice question. I think that I really had the sense at the beginning that the way I was an undesirable way to be. But I also think I was living in a society which was unbelievably prejudiced against gay people. The idea when I was a child, when Time magazine described homosexuality as a pitiable second-rate flight from reality and nothing more than a pernicious sickness, that we could get from there to having a president who endorses gay marriage, I mean, it was unimaginable. And the life I have with a husband and children was unimaginable. So I was very unhappy about who I was, but I was unhappy about who I was partly because of my parents and partly because of the larger world. And it's the fact that what I experienced as an illness is now an identity that made me think some of these other illnesses could be identities.
Well, you were here before to talk about your book about serious depression. Do you think that your experience with depression was related to what happened to you when you were a kid, or would that just simply be a chemical and a genetic thing?
I think that there's no question that it's all tied together. I mean, to try to imagine whether I would have had a depression if I weren't gay is trying to imagine whether I would have had a depression if I were a completely different person. Would I have had one if I were the Prince of Wales? Would I have had one if I were a pro football player? I don't know, maybe, but I would be a completely different person. For me, though, I think that experience of not liking myself and not liking who I saw myself to be in adolescence left some permanent scars.
Did writing this book help you to forgive your parents?
I started off to write the book because I had felt that my parents took a while to come around to my being gay. And they really came around to it, but they were uncomfortable with it at the beginning, and I was very angry about that. And as I worked on the book, I thought, love is something that actually can exist even without acceptance. And I thought what happened was that for a while my parents couldn't quite accept who I was, but I think they always loved me. And in looking at all of these different experiences and seeing the way in which the process of negotiating difference is consistent across such a diverse set of questions, I thought, okay, my parents actually did a pretty good job on the loving front. So I ended up being less angry. I thought everyone has to struggle with this.
In the rave review you got in the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, the reviewer wondered whether this book would be read mostly by people who have children of the sort you're discussing, or whether everyone should read it because some of these issues really apply to just bringing up children.
So I've kind of said in the same way that we test flame-retardant pajamas in an inferno to make sure that our child's sleeve won't catch on fire if he reaches across the stove, that I've looked at these extreme circumstances and tried to see what people do under such pressure. And that I think that by doing it, it illuminates the general experience of parenting, which is to say that I have yet to meet a parent who doesn't at some point say to his child, "Where did you come from?" And I think when a father or a mother says that, they're having to deal with the fact that their child is a separate person, and that's the universal parenting experience.
My guest is Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, an Atlas of Depression, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of 14 national awards, including the 2001 National Book Award. He is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University and special advisor on LGBT affairs at Yale University's Department of Psychiatry. His latest book, also an award winner just the other day, right? Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It's published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation right after this. We're back with Andrew Solomon. His latest book, Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner. And I've been circling around an award. What I've been thinking about was in the Sunday Times, just this weekend, they had a list of the 10 best books of the year, and one of them was the book we are discussing, Far from the Tree. How did you conduct your research for this book?
The research was incredibly labor-intensive. The book took 11 years to write. I ended up with 40,000 pages of interview transcripts. I went off to try to find people in each of these communities that I was looking at.
So, was everybody willing to talk to you? I'd imagine
not
some people would be rather reluctant. These are the deep, dark secrets of many people's lives.
Yes. I found that a lot of people have a great need to tell their story. But what I found most of all was that a lot of these people said, what I experienced made me feel very alone. And if telling my story to you will help someone else to feel less alone when they're going through their experience, then I'm game for it.
Now, we mentioned deafness, which can be invisible unless people are conversing through sign language on the subway, as I just saw this morning. But dwarfism is impossible to ignore, and people do stare. What kinds of issues do parents of dwarfs have to deal with?
Parents of dwarfs have to deal with the fact that their children are seen as comical. One of the dwarfs said to me, it's like being a celebrity without any of the money. You've got everybody recognizing you. You've got everybody looking at you. You go out to eat. I go out with dwarfs who have become friends. I could be with Madonna or a ring-tailed lemur. I wouldn't get more stares. So I think they have to deal with that. They also sometimes have to deal with health complications, skeletal problems.
But they don't have to be – there's no issue with mainstreaming because there are no intellectual differences.
There are no intellectual differences. There is a big controversy about this procedure called limb lengthening, which is a very traumatic physical procedure in which the bone is broken in many places and then it begins to knit together and it's pulled apart and knits together. Can give people some extra height, but it means years in a wheelchair. So there are some parents and some dwarfs who want to do that. There's also a very strong resistance to it as inhumane and barbaric.
And it must be really tough for these kids when they reach the teenage years and puberty.
I think it is. I think a lot of them have lots of friends when they're younger, and then when they get to the dating age, people don't necessarily find them erotically appealing and therefore are less interested in dating them. But that's why I think in this community, as in all, it's important to have both a foot in the sort of outside world and a foot in a community of other people with your same situation.
Well, is this a purely horizontal situation, or does dwarfism run in families? Does deafness run in families?
All of these things can run in families, but most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. It's usually a chondroplasia is usually a randomly occurring genetic mutation. Some of the other kinds of dwarfism are caused by the particular combination of parents. But certainly dwarfs who have children have a good chance of having children with dwarfism.
What about Down syndrome?
Down syndrome, of course, is also in general a randomly occurring genetic mutation. And Down syndrome is one of these areas, like deafness actually, where we have enormous social progress at the same time that we have enormous medical progress. And they're intersecting in a very strange way. So people with Down syndrome are now living three times as long as they lived 50 years ago. They have educational and cognitive attainments that were unimaginable. The experience of Down syndrome people is vastly exalted at the exact same moment that we're developing blood tests to allow even more people to terminate such pregnancies.
But we had to have a baby Doe law fairly recently, 1984, that prevented people from letting their children die pretty much through starvation.
Yes. So until that law was passed, it was considered acceptable and in some cases even advisable to let children with severe disabilities just die. And I think that that created a feeling of darkness, not only obviously in the families in which children died, but also for the families who wanted to keep their children, where other people looked very disapprovingly at that.
Well, most Down kids are happy and affectionate. That must be some kind of compensation for the parents.
Oh, I've now met a lot of families of people with Down syndrome. And Down syndrome is difficult, and there's heartbreak when you run up against limitations. But the depth of the emotional connection is profound over and over again. And most of the people I met feel deeply in love with their children.
And you're right about Tom and Karen Robarts, who founded the Cook Foundation in New York City, both Harvard MBAs who worked on Wall Street. So how did they react to their son's disability?
So they were involved in helping to bring about some of the educational reform that has taken place. They started this very tiny center, which then grew to actually be an important force in the education of such kids. The thing that was most striking to me in my conversation with them was when I talked to them about it all, I said, well, you've devoted the last 23 years of your life to trying to help people with Down syndrome. It's been your whole focus. Do you wish it had never happened? Do you wish your son didn't have it? And his mom said, you know, for David, I wish that he didn't have it, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 23 years ago I could get to such a point. Speaking for myself, the experience has made me a better person than I would ever have been, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
Didn't many of the parents, no matter what the problem with their child, express something similar?
A lot of them did. And at first I thought, it's so curious that all of these parents with all of these children with all of these challenges wouldn't rather have some other children who don't have those challenges. But I thought, it's really the universal nature of parenting. I mean, if some glorious angel dropped in my living room ceiling and said, I'm here to take away the children you have and to give you others who are nicer and brighter and more attractive, I would be horrified. So I think that parents form deep attachments to their children. And I think, if nothing else, that the working on this book showed me that those children, with all of those conditions, are as fully human as anyone else, fully human to their parents and should be fully human to the eyes of the larger society.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. His latest book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the big controversies, returning to autism for a moment, is why we've seen this explosion in autism. Some people say it's just better diagnosis, but others point out that where it used to be one in many thousands and now it's one in a few hundreds, it can't just be a diagnosis issue. What did the people you spoke to suggest might be the causes?
There are so many theories that are circling around and nobody really knows. One of the causes may be older fathers. There's some fairly robust stuff saying that older fathers are more likely to have autistic children and people are reproducing later. But there are so many possible environmental toxins. There are so many experiences. There are issues of whether mothers have been using their cell phones while they were pregnant. There are a million things out there, and none of them has yet had any real substance. But it appears that there are genetics strongly involved in autism and that those genetics may be becoming more concentrated.
Do many marriages, well, they all feel the strain. How many fall apart due to the stress of an exceptional child?
You know, there are studies that argue that more people get divorced with these children. There are other studies which actually have shown that fewer people get divorced, and there are a bunch of studies that say it's all the same. So the research is confusing. But my shorthand was that a lot of the time, people with very strong marriages, the marriage got stronger as they united around the problem. And people with marriages that were already troubled tended to break up completely when they were confronted with something this overwhelming.
And did money was that a factor at all? People were more comfortable and could withstand all of the expenses?
I think the expenses are an enormous issue, but I also found that people who are wealthier are often more perfectionistic and like to be able to solve and fix problems, and that in some cases, people with fewer advantages had an easier path to accepting children whom they wouldn't be able to fix. So money can be mostly a blessing, but it can also be a problem.
And, I'm sure a lot of parents also worry about these children outliving them. If they are always in need of care, what happens then?
So one of the big questions is placement. At what point do you have a child like this? Do you put them in some kind of a home? And there are lots of parents who say, this child would live with me as long as I live. But the problem with that is that then when the parent dies, the child has to not only adjust to having lost a parent, but also to going to live in a new place with new routines and so on. And it's often more humane to try to move the child when you can do so gently and when you can help the child to make the adjustment. But it's a very difficult call because you get more love at home. There's no question about that.
When we talked about people blaming themselves earlier, you mentioned when a child commits a crime. Isn't that fundamentally different from the other conditions that you examine here?
My purpose in including that chapter was to show that the experience of parents of having these difficult, incomprehensible children can have to do not only with how those children were born, but also with where they came from, which is why I have a chapter on children conceived in rape, or what they do, which is why I have the chapter on crime. And I feel like we finally stopped blaming parents for autism and Down syndrome and dwarfism, and we still blame them for criminality. And I think our doing so is incredibly unproductive because often, as I looked at these stories, the criminality felt to me more like a disease than many of the diseases I was looking at.
You say that you wanted to write about criminals since you saw Paul Van Hooten making the case for parole for his daughter, Leslie Van Hooten, who was one of the Manson girls. Why? What was so? What struck you so much about that interview?
I felt that he still saw her as the child he had nurtured at home and that he couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that she had really committed this terrible crime. He kept saying, oh, well, it was just because she was on marijuana. He was sort of still making excuses for her. And I thought not being seen is something, one of the many things that can drive people toward extreme acts.
There's a scene in at the end of Rosemary's Baby where she realizes that her child is the son of Satan, but she feels as though she can raise him to emphasize the better part of his nature.
Yes, well, that's what everyone would like to be able to do. And if you actually have the child of Satan, it can be tricky.
And I'm sure there are people who, when the kid is really being difficult at 3 or 4, wonder whether they have begotten the child of Satan. You also spoke to Tom and Sue Klebold, the parents of Dylan Klebold, who was responsible for the Columbine killings. Why do you think they were willing to talk to you?
They hadn't been able to talk for a long time because they had various pending lawsuits. And Sue had heard me lecture, and we therefore had some basis for beginning. But I think they were very full of their story, and they wanted to tell the story, A, that they had not been not only up and supportive of, but had been horrified by what Dylan did, and B, to talk about the fact that actually he was a complicated person who ended up doing something appalling, but that there was more to him than that. I think they wanted to tell their story. I remember Sue Klebold describing to me how good he had been at math as a child and how he would do equations on the refrigerator. And then she said, you can't imagine how long it's been since I got to boast about my son.
Well, we always hear when somebody does something terrible that he was a nice boy, he was very courteous, the neighbors liked him, because we're all complicated.
I think we're all complicated, and I think many of us are unknowable, and I think Dylan Klebold was very good at keeping secrets. At the end of the first weekend I spent with Tom and Sue, whom I interviewed over 5 years, we were exhausted. We'd recorded 20 hours of interviews. We were sitting around the kitchen table, and I said, is there anything you'd want to ask Dylan if he were here now? And his father said, I'd want to ask what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother looked at the floor and thought for a minute and then said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head.
But I seem to remember that Anna Freud said all teenagers are psychotic on some level. And it's really hard to tell the difference between a kid who's just acting strange and a kid who might really do something awful.
Absolutely. And I saw a home video that had been taken of Dylan going to his prom 3 days before the massacre. And I thought, okay, he seems a little grumpy, but he's 17. 17-year-olds seem grumpy. I wouldn't have known.
You also include a section you mentioned earlier on rape victims who've kept their child. For the most part, was that a matter of choice?
It was, for the most part, a matter of choice. Some of them kept their child through religious conviction, some of them because they didn't really believe they were pregnant and didn't organize themselves well enough to deal with it, some of them because they were in situations in which they had no access to termination.
Well, you went to Rwanda, but would the children of rape there, because, which was part of the Civil War, be the same as the child of a rape victim in the United States?
I went to Rwanda because I wanted to look at how it was in a society in which what is exceptional here is something that's happening on a mass scale. Those women never had access to abortion. It's not legal in Rwanda. And they had been through so much pain and so much difficulty. And I always remember the last one I talked to who said to me when I asked her at the end of an interview whether she had a question for me, she looked at me and I thought she'd ask how long I was staying in Rwanda or something. And she said, "Can you tell me how to love my daughter more?" And I said, "To love her." And she said, "Yes, I want to love her so much. When I look at her, I think about what happened to me. Can you tell me how to love my daughter more?" And unfortunately, it was only much later that I thought how much love was in that question itself.
But you decided, despite all of these conversations, to become a father during the course of writing and publishing this book. Did it change your perception on how you might proceed as a parent?
You know, a lot of people were incredulous that I was having children while working on this and said, "But it's a book about everything that can go wrong." And I said, "It's actually not. It's a book about how much parental love can survive even when everything goes wrong."
But you did say you hoped that you would be spared the experience of having an exceptional child.
I did, but I believed that even if I had one, I would be able to love him, and that was what I had needed to discover.
But would you one of the people you speak to is the parent of a prodigy who was already looking into the theory of relativity at the age of 3. Would that have bothered you?
Having looked at the issue of prodigies, which is one of my favorite chapters, I found that having the mind of an adult in the child of a, in the body of a child is not that much easier than having the mind of a child in the body of an adult. So I hope that my children will develop deeply, profoundly, and to an extraordinary extent, but not so early as to have no peers.
You actually had a scare after the delivery, didn't you?
Yes. The day after our son was born, the pediatrician came in and said he wasn't extending his legs correctly, that that could be related to brain damage, that he was extending them inconsistently, asymmetrically, and that that could be related to a tumor of some kind. It was this terrifying thing. And we ended up, it was only about 5 hours that we were having MRIs and so on, but with a newborn, the day after he was born. And I felt at the time, on the one hand, my book is about how much meaning people have found in these experiences, and on the other, I was hoping not to have them.
We got a call from Diana Montford, who says she's the world's first transgender journalist on cable TV since 1990. And she asks, how is it that some people can overcome prevailing ideas, especially parents, like her own very accepting parents, while others can't?
I think different people have different levels of flexibility in them. I think that they come from different backgrounds and different social circumstances. I was appalled as I worked on the transgender chapter by how much hatred there is for transgender people, how much pointless, ludicrous, reasonless hatred there is, and how much hatred they have to go through, many of them from their own families. Many other families were incredibly accepting and loving, and I felt the ones who were accepting and loving were the ones who saw the child as a separate being and wanted his happiness or her happiness rather than the ones who saw the child as an extension of the parent.
I understand you've started a website.
Yes.
Are people writing in and talking about their own experiences?
They are, and I'd love for more people to do that. It's farfromthetree.com, and the idea is to build a hub where people can compare stories. Because I've argued that really, while each of these differences individually is isolating, there aren't that many people with schizophrenia, there aren't that many people with Down syndrome, the experience of dealing with difference within the family is huge and universal and bonding.
And we will post a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Andrew Solomon is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University, special advisor on LGBT affairs to Yale University's Department of Psychiatry, and the author of the National Book Award winning The Noonday Demons, An Atlas of Depression. It was also a bestseller. And now, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, published by Scribner, chosen by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of the year. Thank you so much for being with us again.
What a pleasure it's been. Thank you.